Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
Hey everyone, this is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, in February, I was meeting with a mastermind of other small business owners, and everyone in the mastermind, they have an online business. Some are podcasters. One guy has an online t-shirt business. Another gal focuses on health. Well, anyhow, as the meeting was wrapping up, they made a suggestion to me on how to change my podcast. Now, to be honest with you guys, I was a little hesitant at first. I'll talk about that change a different time, but that's not all. They made another suggestion to me that really hit home. They suggested for me to do a new feature and something to do just once a month. They suggested that I should have a monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances and outside of finances. I thought it was such a great idea, I reached out to my contacts. And our next guest was generous enough to share with us his journey and his wisdom. As a matter of fact, he is the first guest in this new fireside chat. Now, to confess to you guys, I was re-listening to this after recording it, and there's a few pops that take place on the audio, and I can't figure out how to remove them, but it's a really good conversation. You're going to love it. Our next guest, he is an ENT physician. He has been working since he was 15 years old. He has paid for college through medical school, plus he's gotten 2 additional graduate degrees. And now he is finally practicing after 18 years since his high school graduation. So this is so amazing. You're going to love it. I just such enjoyed learning about his journey. So please help me welcome Dr. Eric Gantworker.
Welcome, Eric.
Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.
Well, we are so glad to have you with us. So first, tell us a bit about yourself, just a little bit. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I originally grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. My father was a grade school teacher at the Chicago Public Schools, actually, and my mom was a benefits person for an accounting firm. Grew up in a middle-class home, went to a good high school. My parents moved out of Chicago proper to the suburbs so that my brother and I can go to a good school system and a good high school. Grew up in, like every other random kid in Chicago, graduated high school and went on to actually Madison, Wisconsin for college. Stayed there for about a year and then ended up having to come home to kind of recenter myself and went to community college actually for a year while I worked full-time and also had a part-time job during that year as well. Did a lot better, transferred back to a 4-year university down at University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. That's sort of where all my medicine interest blossomed. And we can talk about that more in a little bit. But I'm the second physician in my family. Actually, my brother was a physician before me. And part of the reasons why I didn't want to become a physician was because I didn't want to follow my brother's footsteps.
Older brother, I take it then?
Yes, exactly.
So your older brother, what kind of physician is he?
He's actually a neurosurgeon who specializes in spine.
Oh, wow. So you did pick a different specialty. And as a matter of fact, this reminds me of a client where the dad was an orthopedic surgeon, and the son, the older of the two brothers, definitely knew he wanted to be in medicine, just like your brother. But he didn't want to do what dad did, right? So he went into the ER. And little brother, initially, he wanted nothing to do with medicine because dad was in medicine, brother was in medicine, and just the jostle just like you. And once he went into college and he got to experience things and get a feel for his life, he did decide he wanted to get into medicine. He ended up being just like his dad and became an orthopedic surgeon. And what's so interesting to me about your journey is you didn't have a doctor in your family until your brother became one. So I'm really curious, what led to that? Why did you choose and why did you want to be in medicine?
So that's a great question. You know, my brother actually was the very traditional medicine person who knew, you know, from birth he was born with a stethoscope around his neck and knew, like, you know, lined everything in his life, you know, very type A. You know, he knew, I need to do this so I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And so he went straight from college, you know, high school to college to medical school to residency to fellowship and then went straight in. So he had no time off whatsoever. I was a little bit more type B than my brother, so I was more of the atypical find your life kind of person. I was actually really sick when I was a kid, and I was in the hospital probably about 50 times. I was hospitalized. I had really bad asthma starting from about age 5, so I sort of got much of a more laissez-faire kind of let things happen, some things are out of my control kind of attitude, and I think that's kind of where that was born out of. And so when I got to medical school, or when I got to college, actually, I sort of thought that I didn't want to do medicine. My brother was doing medicine, and that wasn't for me. So I actually followed in the footsteps of my uncle, who is a chemical engineer, and he worked for companies like Quaker Oats and Pepsi and things like that. And I was like, you know, food science, chemical engineering is really cool, so that's what I started doing. And obviously, I didn't do very well my first year because I was trying to, you know, be a kid, and I didn't do so well. Came back, sort of knew that I still wanted to do food science, and I actually went through junior college for 1 year and then transferred to University of Illinois as a food scientist. And one day, I was just walking on the quad there and ran into a group that was teaching people how to become emergency medical technicians. And they worked all the football games and all the basketball games. And I was like, you know, that seems pretty interesting. And you can get your license just by joining the club. They actually go through the training. And that was sort of my first exposure to anything medicine. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I loved working with patients. I loved working, learning about medicine. And I ended up getting a job sort of serendipitously at the local trauma center, working in the emergency room. And that sort of recentered myself and said, okay, well, I think this is it. I think this is what I want to do. And so initially I was like, you know, let's do, you know, paramedic. So I did my paramedic work. I was volunteering firefighter down in Champaign. And then I said, you know what, I want to be something more than this. And so I decided, you know, end of my junior year of college and almost into my fourth year of college that I wanted to do medicine. And I had been doing chemical engineering, food science up until that point, and I switched, which actually had to extend me out another 6 months in college. I switched to biochemistry, took all the required prereqs, and then started applying to medical school. And
what age was this now? So how old are you now at this point?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I guess I was would have been 22 at this point when I graduated college. I graduated in December of 2001, so I was 22 years old at that time.
So you did have, in terms of normal graduation, you know, it wasn't like you were extended out in terms of
no,
being
I think
25
I was, right, exactly. No, I was extended out about 6 months, but that first year I actually didn't get into medical school. I did get into a medical school that I decided wasn't a good fit for me. And so I actually looked into graduate school programs when I didn't hear back. And so I ended up applying to two programs. Both were post-bac programs. One was at Tulane, one was at Georgetown. And I ended up going to the one at Georgetown, basically taking classes with the medical students and getting a master's degree through that program. And so that was probably the shining moment of my life, probably one of the best decisions I ever made. I was actually packing up I got a call at 3 in the afternoon that I got into the Georgetown program on a Friday. And then I got a call 30 minutes later from the medical school saying that I got pulled off the wait list and they needed to know by the end of that day. So I had 2 hours to decide my life. Was I going to go to medical school, which was, you know, obviously it's so difficult to go through the process, not only financially, but emotionally, physically, you know, having to rewrite all your essays, having to reapply to all these medical schools. It's a big process. And in 2 hours, I had to make that decision. And essentially, at the end of the day, I always decided that the easy road was to go to the medical school that I got into, even though I didn't think it was the right fit and didn't give me the best opportunity, versus moving to D.C. and going to grad school and then having to go through this whole process again, not even taking into account the financial ramifications of that decision. And I decided to go the harder road. I decided to go to graduate school to improve my grades, to give myself a better opportunity to get into a medical school that I thought fit my personality better and that gave me more opportunity. And so I made that decision in 2 hours and made the tough call to the medical school to say, you know what, I think I'm gonna pass for right now.
So take me back to that moment. You're sitting there. Were you in turmoil? You know, what was going on?
Oh, I was in utter turmoil. I was in utter turmoil. You know, so like I said, you know, I'm a little bit more of a type B than the normal physicians are. You know, I'm a little more laissez-faire. And so I think that what I decided was that my whole life I'd sort of taken the easy road, and my brother would attest to that because he always thought that I always took the easy road. There's actually a joke in our family that when I was a kid, my brother turned to me because I got a D in my class, and he said, "How do you live with yourself?" And I always say that was a tough thing to hear from your brother when you're in second grade. So he always thought that, you know, I took the easy road. And so it was for me, it was a life decision to say, you know what, I'm going to take the hard road because I think it's going to be more beneficial for me. And it was definitely an inflection point in my life, was those 2 hours. And it was a tough, tough decision, I have to say. I'm glad I only had 2 hours to make it. Because if I had longer, I probably would have lamented that decision. I would have mulled it over, and I would have had a lot more time. And I make better decisions on instinct, to be honest. And so I think that was beneficial that it was only 2 hours.
So you went through college. You were working full-time and part-time, it sounds like. Tell us about one of the big issues that we talk about on the podcast all the time is debt. Up to this point, how has debt been part of that journey?
That's a good question. So, you know, from an early age, I always wanted to work. You know, that was one thing that my parents instilled in us was a work ethic. And, you know, if we wanted to spend any money on anything or hang out with our friends, it had to come from our own. So, actually, I opened a checking account when I was 15. I got probably 25-hour a week job at the local ice cream shop, and that was about 15. Mm-hmm. By the age of 16, I was an assistant manager. You know, I was in charge of closing, opening. You know, I was doing training of all new employees. It was a huge responsibility when I didn't even have a driver's license. My dad literally had to drive me to work every day and pick me up. And then finally, when I got my own driver's license, I was working a little bit more often, lots of weekends. You know, basically trying to amass some money, spending money for myself, never with the intention of saving for college because, you know, my brother was supported by my family through all of his college. So, you know, he got small grant or scholarships, but for the most part, my parents supported his education. And then my first year out, my parents supported my education my first year, but after that, it was all on my own. So I paid for junior college. I took out loans for college down at the University of Illinois, and, you know, because it was in-state tuition, it was a little bit cheaper, so it sort of made it a little bit easier for me. But that year that I was at junior college, I transitioned to a retail location, and I was working probably 35 hours a week, and then on top of that, I was tutoring 2 days a week for 5 hours each, so about 10 hours of tutoring on top of my normal class load there. I actually did really well that year because I was so focused, and I allocated my time very well. And it was all, you know, amassing some spending money so that I can make things a little bit easier because a lot of things I paid for myself. I had my own checking account. I had my own I started getting a credit card really early on. And so I sort of managed my debt from that standpoint forward. And actually, my initial goal was to become financially independent from my parents as soon as possible. And that happened about my second year of college that I just decided, you know, that's it. I'm just going to you know, pull away from my parents, because my parents were modest middle class. My dad was a teacher in Chicago Public Schools, and my mom, you know, worked in benefits. So she didn't make a great deal of money, and the two of them didn't make a great deal of money together. And, you know, we lived in an expensive neighborhood because of the school system. So I tried to become independent financially as soon as possible, as did my brother, actually. We made a concerted effort to, you know, get off their phone plans, get our own phone plans and everything, and financially set ourselves up so that we could be completely independent of them.
And was this something that your parents instilled in you, or was it something you and your brother just chose? You know, what do you think was behind that?
That's really funny, because it's actually the exact opposite. My parents, to this day, I come home to come visit them, and, you know, I'm an attending now, so I have a decent salary, and my parents try to give me $20 to go out on a Saturday night, and I try to tell them, well, that's one drink, but also, like, you guys need the money more than me, you know, you're semi-retired, you know, my mom's on disability, and so, you know, I'm like, keep your $20, I don't need your $20, and they're like, no, you're going to take your $20 and you're going to like it. So it was actually the exact opposite. My parents encouraged us to rely on them. And, you know, they're definitely of the attitude that it's better that I give you while I'm alive than I give it to you while I'm dead. And so they're very, very, very generous. And my brother and I are much more, you know, no, you guys keep it. We understand your financial situation, and we think you need to save more money. You know, you're on a fixed income. And so that's always been my brother and I's attitude, is that we wanted to be financially independent of them as soon as possible. So it was funny, because it was the exact opposite of what they wanted us to do.
Well, isn't that interesting? Well, I know for me, one of my main influence on money is we had, in my family, knew my dad's side the best. And so we had my dad's parents, my paternal grandparents, who just kind of made it. And then we had my great aunt, who was extremely wealthy. And as a matter of fact, she and my uncle, they kind of lived like misers, but they were millionaires multi times over. And so I always wanted to be just like them. So I'd like to know from you, what influenced you in regards to money? What influenced you in your money habits?
Yeah, you know, there wasn't a ton of guidance in my life as to how to budget, how to balance your checkbook. You know, my mom, you know, working for an accounting firm and doing benefits, she was probably the most financially inclined. My dad really didn't worry about it. You know, when he had my mother, and still to this day, he just gives her all the bills to pay for, and he doesn't really worry about it. So I think my mother was definitely an inspiration for me financially, because, you know, she taught me how to balance my checkbook, and you know, I have my registers from when I was 15 years old. You know, I can see exactly what I spent every single.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I can see, you know, it's actually in a box at my parents' house. And I can see exactly what I was writing checks for and you know, balancing my budget. And I tried as much, you know, not use cash so that I can keep track of my finances. And my brother, too. My brother was very good at keeping track of his finances. But I think I was a little bit more of an easy spender when I was younger than my brother and my parents. My parents always joke that I got a Coconuts, which was a music store in suburbs of Chicago. I got a $20 gift certificate to Coconuts at my job, just as a present. And I came home and I told my parents, I was like, I got a $20 gift certificate. They're like, oh, where is it? I was like, I spent it on the way home. And so my parents were like, you know, you always felt like money was burning a hole in your pocket. And so I wasn't very good at budgeting, but I sort of knew the value of money because I was working for it. My mom always jokes, actually, when I came home from my first job, I said, somebody stole my money. And she said, what do you mean somebody stole your money? I was like, I worked this many hours, I made this much money, and I came home and the check was half of what I'm supposed to get. And she said, let me see. She says, that's taxes. I was like, what are taxes? Why did people steal my money? So, I was 15, and my mom still tells that story. you know, so I learned at a very early age, you know, like, you know, the value of money and what it meant to pay taxes at 15 years old.
Man, and I'm sure now you know more than ever who's stealing your money and how much.
Oh, exactly.
It is, right? you lived up to this journey. You've now made the decision to go for your master's program.
Right.
Right. So take us from there. What happened
Sure.
from there?
So to say that my master's program was a financially a poor decision is an understatement. The tuition was very high. I tried to get some scholarships. I tried to get some grants and ended up getting loans to pay for not only school but also room and board. And room and board in D.C. was not inexpensive. I was paying a lot of money for this. But I think it was a transition point in my life. Actually, a lot of people that once they found out that I actually got into medical school and had turned it down, a lot of my friends were very upset with me because basically everybody in this program were people who were trying to improve their resume to get into medical school. And so, people really like actually hated me because of it, that I'd actually, when they found out that I turned down medical school. But it was an excellent time in my life because I made, some friends because we were all in the same lot in life, lifelong friends. One of my best friends is from that program and, a couple other best friends actually as well. And it was a great year because I got away from home. It was my first time very, very far from home because even Illinois was only about 2 hours from my parents' house. And so, I came from a background where I already had some medical exposure. I had some life experience. I worked in the ER. I was working on an ambulance. I was a volunteer firefighter. I was on the medical team at the fire department. And so I had a lot of background knowledge in a lot of the more clinical applications, which I think was very different from a lot of people in that program. And I think because I had that background in medicine and I had that grounding knowledge, that it actually helped me fit all of the knowledge that I was learning, all the basic science and stuff, into more clinical applications, which made me learn it a lot better. And I actually did really, really well that year ended up getting into, I think about 10 medical schools, actually.
Wow. Were you an EMT?
Yeah, I was.
You were a volunteer firefighter?
Wow.
Yeah, just a quick aside. I was at this one point early in my career. One of the things I had to do starting out in this business was door knock. I worked for Edward Jones. So I went door to door. So I got super burned out. I was just emotionally, did that for almost a year. And I don't recommend that to anyone. Don't knock on doors. Horrible way to market yourself.
That is tough but life.
It is cheap. And so I was at this point, I was burned out. And I actually became a volunteer firefighter. My father-in-law was a full-time firefighter in Washington State. And so just because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and I found out that was not it for me. I'm good with my mind, but not so good with speed, my body. we went on like 3 calls.
Yeah.
And I was always the guy holding the flag, wearing the vest, so I never actually got any practical experience, but it sounds like you did in your volunteer firefighting position.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and also I ended up getting, at that point there was the B level license, which was like kind of the intro basic. And then there was sort of the advanced life support, which was the next level of EMT. And then there was the paramedic license. And actually it was a year of transition where the paramedic license became an associate's degree. But then all of the training that was incorporated into the paramedic license actually dropped down to the next level of EMT, the advanced EMT. So I ended up trying to get my advanced EMT license. But at that point, I'd already, I went through all the coursework. I did all the ride-alongs. I worked on the ambulance. I had, fantastic opportunities to learn from the paramedics there. I learned a ton from the nurses. I learned how to start IVs and all this stuff that when I worked in the trauma center at the same time as being on the rig. And, that really, in retrospect, it really changed my life as a physician, having that experience. And I think I much more appreciate multidisciplinary teams because of that, because I learned from the paramedics, I learned from the nurses, and I understand the dynamics of the team. And when, things go wrong in an emergency room, in a trauma bay, in a rural area, you have to rely on that team. And I think I got a sort of a gestalt of how the system works and how teams work. And I think it's definitely helped me as a physician in general. But, I ended up not finishing that EMTP license because I was going to medical school. So I ended up not even testing out and then sort of let it lapse. But at least I got the training for it, and it was invaluable going forward.
Well, I got to imagine you're in medical school now at this point in the journey that we're talking about, and you've actually been on calls. You've seen trauma.
Oh, yeah.
Was that different, versus some of your peers in medical school that, they just had book knowledge, or am I off base on that?
No, there's definitely people who you can definitely tell the difference. And now that I do interviews for residency, for fellowship, for medical school, I can see the difference in life experience from the people who are, went from high school to medical school to residency, the people that sort of knew from the beginning that they were going to be a doctor and they were going to stay on this pathway and they were going to go through it till the end because they didn't have that life experience.
All right, well, let's just take a pause here for a second and go for our commercial break. If you're like most members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is you've never received financial training during medical school, and you struggle with having enough time to do it all. And maybe you've even made a few mistakes along the way. And that's exactly why I wrote my new ebook, The Tax Reduction Prescription, and the brand new ebook, 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes. Now, as a matter of fact, you can't buy 5 Steps to Overcome, but you can get the entire ebook for free by subscribing to my free email newsletter. My email newsletter notifies you whenever I've posted fresh content to my podcast, so you don't always have to visit my podcast website. Plus, my newsletter subscribers get the first crack at exclusive offers and lots of free stuff. You can get an excerpt from the Tax Reduction Prescription and your free copy of 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes ebook by visiting drfreedompodcast.com. And just simply enter your name and email in the form on the page. Okay, well, I want to fast forward now. You're out of medical school, you're in residency. Did you have a pile of debt, or did you have just enough saved up from all your working years? Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I had a pile of debt. I think that for me, the undergraduate education was not very expensive. You know, junior college and in-state tuition on the whole was probably put me back about $25,000 maybe. And then Georgetown itself was extremely expensive. Between tuition and housing, I think it was about $50,000 at that time, and that was in 2003. And so I went into medical school with a ton of debt. And medical school, I did not, I didn't have enough loans because I had to take out loans, obviously, for medical school. And I got some grants and some scholarships that I was applying to, all kinds of scholarships. And I got some decent ones that helped, kind of defray the cost. But on the whole, I still accumulated all this financial debt through medical school. So now I'm entering residency and I have, probably maybe $100,000, something like that. No, more than that. I entered residency with about $200,000 in debt. It was very daunting. And so my residency, I went to Cincinnati. So it wasn't a huge cost of living. But we may talk about it in a second, but my worst decision was not to start paying down that debt. I more went into deferment for the first couple of years because you can go into economic hardship deferment. And so I took advantage of that. But at that time, you can only do it for 2 years. So after the first 2 years of residency, I was in deferment. I hadn't paid very much at all except for anything that I had to. And then I went into forbearance for a few years. We may talk about it in a second, but that was a horrible decision. I was living in different places. I actually moved 18 times in 18 years. I've never lived to the same address for more than 2 years. And so there was a lot of debt incurred by me constantly moving as well, which I tried to defray by actually roping in my friends to help me move, which quickly exhausted itself.
It's like that commercial. Commercial on Comcast.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Can you help me move? I'm busy right now.
I'm doing my hair. So that was sort of what happened with my friends. I did not do a very good job of managing my debt at that time.
Let's think about that. If you could do it over. You have that time back. You're talking to yourself as a first-year resident, or maybe you're just talking to a first-year resident.
What would you encourage them to do or to learn from your situation?
Sure, absolutely. The first thing I would say is learn how to budget. Budgeting was the one thing that was the North Star that I missed. I sort of just generally thought, okay, this is how much money's coming in, this is how much is coming out, but I didn't really think about, when I was going to dinner, when I was going to the movies, what is this going to impact my debt, and can I afford to pay, income repayment plan for my loans? I didn't even think about that. All I could think about was, I want to have as much spending money as possible right now, so I'm just going to defer my loans, and I'm going to go into forbearance on my loans. And I think my biggest advice for first year is, number one, budget. Look to every possible nook and cranny, every penny. Know where every single penny is going so that you know, can I afford to go to the movies this weekend? Or if I want to go to the movies this weekend, maybe I should eat at home this week, kind of things. And I didn't really think about that. The other thing that I would say is try to pay your loans. One thing that I found about later in life was about a loan forgiveness plans. Right now there's a loan forgiveness plan through the federal government that if you repay your loans for 10 years and you are in a needed area, which most academic hospitals, nonprofits are, then you can actually have loan forgiveness. And for me, now that I'm an attending, to start that repayment, the minimum is 10 years repayment at the current my current salary. So it doesn't behoove me to do that. But if I had been paying for 5 years of residency, then I would have only had to pay 5 years as an attending, and then I would have had loan forgiveness. But it was one of those things that, I didn't really think about it. I was more worried about my training. And I have to say, people in medicine in general are not very good business savvy. We're not very good at budgeting, and we're not very, we got a financial talk when I was a resident that was excellent. And they talked about the biggest mistake that physicians make, and that's, once they get money, they spend it.
Right.
Yeah. So that would be my advice, is budget, and don't fall into that cliche of spending the second you have money. Really, really budget, really know your options. Especially primary care right now is giving a lot of loan forgiveness through the federal government. So if you want to work in underserved areas and you want to do primary care, you can get loan forgiveness for your entire medical school. And even medical students.
State.
Yeah. Exactly. And I recommend medical students look into as many loans, scholarships, grants that they can, because it really makes a difference at the end of the day when you look back on your debt and you're like, oh my God, if I had paid X down, or if I had started putting $10 a week into a savings, what would that be? Compounding is not something that people understand until it's too late. Definitely I fall into that now that I'm 37 years old and I'm finally, making an attending salary, and I have friends who are in the financial industry or have been working since graduating college, and they have like 16 years of working on me, at probably salary that's equal to mine right now. And that's daunting for most physicians to understand, like, hey, these guys have been living the life for 16 years while I've been in school. And it's a tough thing to deal with, especially when those are your friends, right? And you want to go out and hang out with them, and they're making this salary, and you're not. You're making a resident salary for a long time. And then I think that's part of the desire to spend when people finish, because they're, hey, I can finally do what my friends in business do. Let's go on a trip for 2 weeks to Europe,
Yeah. Well, what I'll do, I have in the show notes, I'll link for everyone listening. If you're curious about PSLF or the different repayment programs, I'll link in the show notes to some of that stuff so you guys can check that out. So you're getting through residency. Did you do any fellowship, or was it just a 4-year residency?
So of course, why would I ever start working? My friends always joke. I have a good friend who's a retina specialist outside of LA, and he always told me, I think you hate money. Because I decided to do a fellowship. I decided to go into pediatric ENT because I really liked working with kids, and I just liked that population. And so I ended up moving to Boston. and doing a fellowship there at Boston Children's, which was a fantastic experience, but once again, not very financially sound. Boston was exquisitely expensive to live in. And again, you know, walking in with all of my debt. Exactly. And so again, you know, you're there, you're paying all your rent. And you know, cost of living is so high that I couldn't even fathom contributing anything to my loans. And so, you know, during that year I just focused on my studies and again went into, I think at that point you could do deferment again. And so I went back into deferment on my loans and you know, paid a minimum of whatever I could on the interest and just, you know, held my head low, tried to get through that year and say, you know, once I'm an attending, I'll start paying down that debt. It was a great experience. And, of course, while I was there, I decided that I wanted to pursue more of my medical education niche. And so I ended up going into a master's of medical education program at the Harvard Medical School there. And, you know, again, trying to amass more debt at higher education institutions.
Wow.
So that's where I started my second master's program that I'm currently in. It was a two-year master's program and, you know, doing lots of work with medical education research, and again, having to pay tuition. I worked part-time my year after fellowship year. I stayed in Boston, and I worked you know, doing one day a week of seeing patients. The program there, my hospital, my home hospital, my home department was very generous to help support me financially during that time with a base salary of about equal to what my fellowship was. I was able to go to school 4 days a week. And work one day a week, and that sort of paid my salary for that year and helped support my cost of living. But again, you know, I have this, you know, huge number when I sign into my loans that at this point is all Monopoly money in my mind. You know, I basically mortgaged Boardwalk and Park Place haven't really worried about it since.
Fast forward now to now you're in practice at this point. I would love to hear about, with all this debt that you have on top of maybe wanting to save for retirement or buy your first house, you know, how are you going about or have been going about financial decisions? What does that look like for you?
That's a great question. And honestly, physicians have a very unique position, you know, where you have a lot of debt. It's education debt. And only certain advisors who work with physicians a lot sort of understand the opportunities, you know, like these grants or the loan forgiveness programs through the federal government, things like that, you know, the lifetime learning tax rebate, you know, things like that, and something very, very unique to physicians. And they sort of understand the mentality, you know, and my advisor sat me down. The first thing he told me is the number one mistake physicians make is the second they become an attending, they buy a car, they buy a house, they start traveling, and they have all this debt that they haven't even touched yet. So, you know, he definitely prepared me for that and said, you know what, we're not going to do that. We're going to live within your means. We're going to budget. You know, he worked with me on making a budget saying, okay, this is how much you're going to pay for this. This is how much you're going to pay for this. And sort of my mindset was, I'm going to live the same type of lifestyle that I lived last year when I was a fellow. I'm not going to change my cost of living. The only thing I've changed is I did have to buy a car because I didn't have one in Boston. It was such a walkable city and the public transportation is so fantastic. I didn't need a car. I ended up buying a car before I moved. Basically, everything else is the same financially for me. You know, we worked on getting a disability insurance plan, which was a probably number one decision. And another advice that I would strongly encourage residents to look into is to start getting a disability policy early on and start paying it. It's worth it. Then as your income goes up, you can increase that without any health considerations in most instances. And I think that was a great decision for me, and having that as a backbone for my financial security. The next thing that my advisor told me was to pay off bad debt. So I did amass some credit card debt, both from medical, from residency and from fellowship. And so the first goal was to pay off all my bad debt, which, you know, I did what I could with keeping that very low. I, you know, I did zero balance transfers to try and, you know, avoid APRs, which I did, you know, successfully, thank God. And now, you know, I'm focusing on just paying down my bad debt, number one. The next thing was, is he talked to me about my educational debt. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to get educational loans at the time when interest rates were really low. So most of my loans are at about 3.5%. And so what his advice was to wait on those, you know, and try to pay off your bad debt, try to, work on your investments, work on your retirement, and then slowly pay down that debt, which is what we're working on now. The next thing he told me was to, save up 6 months' worth of salary, and we're working on that, and I'll be there actually relatively soon.
Post-tax?
Really,
post-tax or pre-tax?
Post-tax
or pre-tax?
Post-tax dollars.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great advice.
And, yes, exactly. And the other thing was, when I went with him, I work for the University of Texas now, and they have a fantastic benefits package. And I'm very, very fortunate to work here. And they didn't pay me to say that. But the greatest thing is they have pre- and post-tax vehicles. And so a thing that I would totally not understand as a physician who's working on, you know, patients, and is, I'm not financially inclined, and the best advice he gave me was, you know, listen, at the end of the day, you want to have post-tax pot and you want to have a pre-tax pot at retirement. And so I'm contributing to those, maximizing those, and they have a very good match here at University of Texas that they're contributing to. And so that is getting, accumulating very fast, and I'm vested after 1 year. Another concept that I wouldn't understand otherwise is vesting. And so, you know, we're working on building that golden nugget at the end. And I'm starting late, obviously. I haven't started really contributing to retirement plans until now. I just turned 37. I was 36 when I started. And most of my friends started when they were 21. So I'm definitely behind the ball when that comes to, to be at the end of retirement. But, you know, I'm trying to catch up as fast as possible.
Here's the question. Are you going to be moving anytime in the next year?
I am trying. You know, I probably will. I live in an apartment right now. I'm looking to move into a house. I have a dog, so I think the dog deserves a yard. He's lived in an apartment his entire life. He's now 5. I probably will move, but I think it's going to be maybe the last time I move for a little while.
Maybe in the same city?
Yeah, same city, yeah. I'm here for a while.
That's an accomplishment.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's a very interesting concept. You know, I actually talked to this about some of my medical friends before, was the concept that we constantly change cities, and it's not a big deal for us when we're in training.
Right.
Because, you know, when I was in D.C., I said, okay, I'm moving in a year. I'm moving somewhere in a year. And when I was in residency or when I was in medical school, it's like, okay, I'm in Chicago for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, I'm probably going to move somewhere. And I moved to Cincinnati where I didn't know a soul. I was there for 5 years, and I knew at the end of 5 years I was going somewhere. And then I moved to Boston where I didn't know anybody. I knew one person, but for the most part, I didn't really know anybody. And then when I was done in Boston, I said, okay, I'm probably going to move somewhere. And it was just a granted thing. And I talked to friends whose wives have grown up in the same city that they were born in. And they never left. They went to college there. They never left. And that was just such a foreign concept for them that we just up and move our lives, change our friends on the drop of a dime. Obviously the financial costs that go into that, but also, you know, the emotional toll that takes when you have to leave all of your friends. You spent 5 years cultivating a friendship with people in the same situation. It was almost like the military, right? You know, you're in the same room.
Yeah.
You have the same group of friends for 5 years. You guys are going through the tough stuff together, and then all of a sudden people graduate and they're gone. It's a high emotional toll that people don't really talk about too much.
Well, on top of the emotions, the other thing I want to get across to people that I'm running into more lately, as I talk to a number of younger physicians is I think people get trapped into wanting to be financially savvy, making good financial decisions, and they go and they buy a house. I was talking to the sweetest people, anesthesiologist and her husband have a bunch of kids, and they now have four houses.
Oh, my God.
I would encourage, and they're underwater in two of them, and they can't sell a third one right now.
Oh,
and so I'd encourage
man.
Everyone listening, be careful about your financial decisions in residency and fellowship. And that's the thing I'm hearing from you as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Be careful about those kind of decisions and really take some time to think about it.
Right. And I think that that's a great point. And like I said, you know, when you're in residency, it's such a hard life. You know, you're working 100 hours a week, you know, well, we say 80, but you're working 80 hours a week. You're trying to find time to sleep when you can. A lot of people have families. A lot of people have kids, and they're, you know, trying to split their time. And, you know, finances usually fall by the wayside unless you have a spouse that's really good at budgeting. But, you know, if you're single and you're in residency, you're just trying to live day to day. You know, when you go home, you don't want to think about, you know, it's cheaper to make dinner when you've been working for 14 hours. You want to, you know, grab something on the way home that's inexpensive. And so people gain weight during residency, too, because they're making poor financial decisions and poor health decisions because you don't focus on your own health. And I think that, you know, some people do buy a house during residency. And obviously a lot of my friends, unfortunately, bought houses right before the bubble burst. And so they're in poor financial situations. A lot of my friends still have houses or properties where they did medical school, and now they're like 10 years out, and they're like, I can't get rid of this place. And so, you know, at first it seemed like a really good decision. And for me, I've always rented, which I thought was a poor decision because I was like, you know, I'm not building any equity. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. And when it came to today, you know, I don't have places that are, you know, sucking money from me right now. But some people were able to turn those into rental properties and are doing well. But I think that the financial situation I'm in now is I have to decide whether to invest or pay off debt. And that is a really tough decision to make on your own, to understand how that works. And so I say again, get yourself to an advisor who understands the physician's lot and can guide you through that decision-making process. Because, you know, for me, I tend to be very debt-averse, even though I have mortgaged Boardwalk and Park Place. I tend to be very debt-averse, and I want to pay down that economic debt, educational debt, as fast as possible. But the recommendations were, don't do that. Pay it actually slowly because you have other vehicles that are going to be more profitable for you and to help you build a nest egg at the end of the day. And don't focus on that. And that's something that's very counterintuitive to me. Is, you know, you have a problem, you fix it. But there's multiple ways to fix that problem, and you have to be forward thinking, and you have to understand all the ramifications and all the implications of what you do with your money. And that was something I didn't understand. And I am fortunate also. I have a friend that I grew up with that I'm very, very close with that did a finance major, and he's probably one of the most intelligent people I've ever met in my entire life. And he's been a huge asset to me, and I talk to him every day about my finance. And so it made me feel a lot better. But a lot of people don't have those people, you know, and I think it's really funny because it's very much like medicine. You know, when you are trying to navigate the medical environment and you're not in medicine, so you're trying to pick a primary care doctor and they give you a list of 500 primary care doctors in your network and you're like, I have no idea who to pick. You know, so you're like, I don't know what to do. So you like try to find friends who are in medicine to like, hey, who would you pick? You know, and so it's the same thing with finances. Like, you know, going in and understanding the financial environment, you have no idea. You know, should I invest in this company? Should I pay off this debt? Should I get this? Should I get that? You don't know because you're not in it. You don't understand it on a regular basis.
Well, I'd like to point out a couple of things to the audience just to be aware of as we're on this topic. And number one thing that I would encourage every physician to think about as they select a financial professional, or if they have one already, I think one of the questions that you have to ask yourself is this person out for my best interests? And there's two acid tests that I would use. Number one, do they work for a company that produces proprietary products, meaning that they have an insurance company that produces insurance stuff, that there might be a conflict of interest. Number two that I would suggest to most folks is do they tend to push insurance products. Something like disability insurance is great, but are they only trying to sell you a cash value life insurance policy and a disability mm-hmm. policy, and then they send you on your merry way? Are they actually giving you holistic advice? So those are two things I would encourage every doc to think about. To wrap up now, and I'd like you to leave people with a couple of closing thoughts, Eric. Number one, I always love turning people on to resources. So what are a resource or two, whether a book or a blog or a podcast or whatever that you think are awesome that you'd point folks to? And then also any other closing thoughts that you have?
No, that's a good question. Actually, my friend recommended a book, and I knew this was going to happen. I totally forgot the name of the book. And it basically goes over financials for physicians. Oh, man.
White Coat Investor?
What is it called?
White Coat Investor? White Coat Investor?
That sounds familiar. So, but that was a book. I haven't read it yet, but he came very highly recommended. So we're working on that. I think other resources is definitely a financial advisor, and they can point you to a ton of resources. But also understanding the ins and outs of your grants. So look on the federal website. There's tons of information there that people don't even know exists, like this loan forgiveness plan. I didn't really understand it, and had I looked at it early on, I would have known, hey, I should start paying my loans on an income-based repayment plan as a resident. And I would be in such a better financial position now had I known that. So the best thing for advice is do your homework. Look at what is out there. Look at the opportunities for loan forgiveness. Look at the opportunities for underserved minorities or underserved areas in medicine, because there's a lot of opportunity there for you financially and clinically, I'll say. Those are great experiences, and everybody who's done them have had great experiences in that. But definitely the books that Dave mentioned, and if I remember, there's another book he recommended. If I remember what it is, I'll come back on and maybe we'll put a resource up for you guys. And my hope is for everybody who's listening is don't give up the dream of becoming a doctor just because of the finances, because I'll tell you, the reward of seeing a kid in the clinic is far beyond any financial reimbursement I'll ever get.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Eric, if people have more questions or they just want to reach out to you, how can they get back in contact with you?
So the best thing is you guys can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Dr. Eric, E-R-I-C, Gant, G-A-N-T, so D-R-E-R-I-C, G-A-N-T, and you can also find me on LinkedIn.
All right, well, if you enjoyed the show, you want to check out the show notes and the resources that Eric and I have been mentioning throughout, make sure to visit the podcast website at www.drfreedompodcast.com. And in addition, I would love to tell your story in this next Fireside Chat. It would be my honor to host you on the next podcast. I know we can learn from your journey, and it will help other doctors. After all, who better to speak to physicians than another physician? I think there's going to be some awesome stuff for us here today and in the future. So make sure to contact me at dave@daviddeniston.com or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Deniston. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a good one.